Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolford. Rockwell Kent was one of the most important artists and painters to picture Alaska. The winter he spent with his son on Fox Island in Resurrection Bay, which he portrayed in a popular book and spectacular art, happened 100 years ago. On today's show, I'll be talking with an expert on those events and Kent's colorful life, Doug Capra. He even met Kent's son before he died decades ago to learn firsthand what that magical winter was like. The story changed Alaska and changed art and nature writing, and today we'll learn why. Stay tuned. I'm Charles Woltforth. It's Outdoor Explorer. You know, one of my very favorite Alaskan artists was Rockwell Kent. He painted those extraordinary pictures of Resurrection Bay that are almost iconic, and you've probably seen them in the museum in Anchorage and other museums, and certainly if you've been to Seward. They're dreamy and they're intense and they're interesting, and we're coming up on the centennial of Rockwell Kent's visit to Alaska, which was such an important part of his life and really part of Alaska's history. And so to talk about that, I've got with me one of the foremost experts on Rockwell Kent, an author and historian who has studied Kent's work and is really involved in the centennial and writing about Kent, and can probably tell us more about him than almost anyone I could have here. And his name is Doug Capra. Thanks for being here, Doug.
Oh, thank you, Charles.
Doug is author, among other books, of The Spaces Between, Stories from the Kenai Mountains to the Kenai Fjords, and some upcoming work about Rockwell Kent as well. And as we get started, Doug, I thought it would be important for those listeners who may not be familiar with Rockwell Kent to talk about it. Like, who are we talking about, and well, why is he important? His work is very, to me, is very dreamy. It's very rich, these marine landscapes, which came out of a very important trip you made to Alaska 100 years ago.
Well, Rockwell Kent was an American artist born in 1882 outside of New York City. And I think it's important to understand that, you know, he was raised in kind of an elite household, semi-wealthy household as a Victorian. So, I mean, he carried the romantic intuition with him and some of the Victorian attributes, although in later life he was to reject that. He studied architecture at Columbia University, but that's not what he really wanted to do. His family wanted him to do that. And so he ended up studying with some of the best art teachers in New York at the time, William Merritt Chase, Robert Henry, Kenneth Hayes Miller, people like that that were the top people at the time. He came to, before he came to Alaska, he went to painted Monhegan Island.
Which is off the coast of Maine.
Off the coast of Maine. He made a couple of trips to Newfoundland, World War I broke out. And by that time, he was married and had four children. And he was a socialist and leaning to the left in many issues. And his family got thrown out of Newfoundland because of his pro-German sentiments. He'd been raised by an Austrian nanny, so he spoke German fluently.
And oh my gosh!
Like a lot of intellectuals of the period,
right.
He was influenced by German culture. Well, anyway, he comes to Alaska, and Alaska. We can talk about that later, but that's a turning point in his life. After Alaska,
well, it's interesting because you talk about Newfoundland and Monhegan Island off Maine, and those are very much. They look a lot like Resurrection Bay in coastal Alaska. And I guess he must have been drawn to that landscape.
Oh, yes. He was drawn to the north. In fact, I'm originally from Massachusetts, and when I was younger, I spent a lot of time in Maine canoeing and hiking, and Maine reminds me a lot of Alaska. You know, it's still a pretty rough and rugged place.
Yeah, very much so.
And Monhegan Island, too.
Which is a little rocky island way off the coast.
Yeah. It is. And anyway, he became, after wilderness was an important point of his life because he finally got recognized. He was 36 years old after his Alaska trip, 1918-1919. And his show in New York and his book, Wilderness, A Journal of Quiet Adventure in Alaska, finally gave him the fame and recognition he needed to earn a living as an artist. Then he goes off to Tierra del Fuego. He goes to Greenland, makes several trips to Greenland, writes several other books. I mean, I like to think of him as maybe one of the last of our real adventure artists like George Catlin and John James Audubon, you know, the real adventurous artists that got out in the wilderness.
And part of this tradition of sort of the East Coast intellectual coming to Alaska and bringing back the Alaska story in some kind of lectures or pictures or book. And in his case, it really caught on. It really caught people's imagination.
Well, yes. Of course, as he got older and more famous, he got more into politics. His early years, his Alaska years, Monhegan Island years, although he was a socialist and he was very outspoken about it, his art didn't reflect that politics. Mm-hmm. But later, his art became more political, too. I mean, it reminds me a little bit of Picasso. You know, how Picasso produces that great mural on the Spanish Civil War,
Guernica.
Eventually. You know, Kent eventually produces this great mural advocating for the rights of the Puerto Ricans. We can talk about that. That was in 1935 when he comes back to Alaska. But anyway, through the 20s and 30s and even the 40s, he was one of the most prominent Alaska graphic artists. And then the McCarthy hearings came. And that pretty much ended his ability to earn a living as an artist. In fact, after
because
he died...
Because he was a socialist, he was identified as a red, and McCarthy was doing the red baiting, sort of flushing anybody with that kind of political record out of culture.
Kent was accused of being a communist, and he refused to answer that question.
Mm-hmm.
But to the press, he'd tell them, I'm not a communist. You know, I've never joined the party, and I don't agree. But he would work for communist front organizations if he agreed with the cause that they were working for.
Mm-hmm.
And so when he died in 1971, the New York Times gave him a front page obituary, and they listed 11 occupations that he had, and they even missed a few. And one of his friends, Louis Uttermeyer, said that he's not one person at all, but possibly the Rockwell Kent Joint and Associated Enterprises, because he produced so many different things. He did all kinds of artwork, anything he had to do to earn a living.
And so he was a true 20th century giant. That was really, really well known all over our country. Yeah.
Yes, and he was such a perfectionist that he took commercial art that he did and raised it such a high level that even today, just go on eBay and type in Rockwell Kent and look at all the collected things people are collecting today.
So what was it about this work that he did in Alaska that was so powerful and so captured the national imagination in such a way that he became a celebrity and became such an important cultural figure?
Well, I think what was there about the art? First of all, it was new, and Alaska was in the news. I mean, the Alaska Railroad was being built between 1915 and 1923, and he's in Seward between 1918 and 1919, that time. So Alaska was in the news, and these were just wonderful pictures. And of course, this was a time when the rugged individual period, back to the land, period was prominent at that time, and so the images just stunned the New York art world, and the pen and ink drawings that he did that later ended up in Wilderness. He did his first woodcut when he was on Fox Island.
Hmm.
That's how he learned that, and then he becomes an expert in that field too.
It strikes me that his work is also somewhat modernistic, as opposed to some of the artists who were popular in Alaska at the time, like Sidney Lawrence, who were like strictly classical romantic artist. Rockwell Kent is transforming his vision with some new techniques and romanticism as well, and extraordinary color, but also kind of smoothing things out and looking at them through a unique vision.
Well, today sometimes he's called a dramatic realist, a realistic painter, but a dramatic realist because he focuses on the elemental things, the sky, the sea, the mountains. You see, when he was in Newfoundland, he was kind of experimenting. His Newfoundland paintings are very depressing paintings, as he was depressed. In Alaska, he experienced a little bit of what some art critics would call symbolism. You'll see some strange kinds of paintings, but there's some also very straight, realistic paintings too.
And there's a kind of a joyful and sort of overwhelming sense, like that feeling, this, which many of us felt when we first get to Alaska, right?
Yes.
Like, wow.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, that's an interesting concept. I'm writing a book about Rockwell Kent in Alaska based on many articles I've written over the years. The book is called That Infinite and Unfathomable Thing, Rockwell Kent's Alaska Wilderness. And in the first chapter, which is going to be published in the fall in a publication called The Kent Review. In that first chapter, I get into, right in the very beginning, how artists in particular, I think of some of the WPA artists in the 30s, they're just awestruck. It's so big. It's so giant. I mean, even John Muir talks about being embosomed in the landscape so much that he just can't describe it. He can describe a little glacier here and there or a mountain, but when he tries to put it all together, he can't do it.
It's overwhelming. Yeah.
Yes, and it's overwhelming, and it stuns, it numbs artists. And it was like that for Kent, too.
Yeah. So what was the particular impetus, I'm getting so interested, I forgot to introduce you again for those who are just tuning in. I'm talking with author Doug Capra, who is an expert on Rockwell Kent, the artist, centennial of Kent's visit to Fox Island and Resurrection Bay is coming up. Doug is author, among many other things, of The Spaces Between, stories from the Kenai Mountains, the Kenai Fjords, and hundreds of articles, and working on a book about Kent. So Rockwell Kent, as you'd already described, had sort of bounced around a little bit and then decides to come to Alaska. Why exactly did he come to Alaska? Was there something he was looking for? Did he know that he was working on a book? What was the impetus?
Well, there. First, I'll tell you, the presentation that I'm doing, the PowerPoint show I do now, is called Unpacking Rockwell Kent, because he's so complicated. So it's kind of complicated. But first of all, he was in love with these kinds of landscapes. He'd been to Monhegan Island. He'd been to Newfoundland. He wanted to go to Iceland. But World War I interrupted that, and he couldn't get to Iceland. Alaska was in the news, you know, and I think that was part of it. His love life was in shambles, and that's we could just do a whole book on his
love life. Well, he'd been married, you said.
He was married. He had four children. But he was also, he had mistresses, and his wife knew about it, and he'd introduce his mistresses to his wife. And
never a good idea.
There was one particular mistress, Hildegard Hirsch was her name. She was a Follies girl in New York City, and he was, that was his current lover at that time he came to Alaska. On top of all that, he's reached this point in his life. He's 36 years old. What am I going to do? I mean, he's working in an architectural firm to support his family, pounding the pavement of New York, trying to sell anything he can, trying to make connections. What am I going to do? How can I support my family and do the work that I need to do? I don't have time to do the work that I need to do. Alaska, I've always said, is a last-ditch effort for Kent. If you read his letters, and I'm up to my ears now in reading his letters, because the Alaska story is in the letters. It hasn't really been told. He tells a little bit about it in his autobiography, and the biography by Traxel that came out in 1980 has a little bit about it, but the details are in the letters. He comes to Alaska hoping to produce a body of work that's finally going to get him the attention. In the letters, you even see signs that he's thinking of committing suicide. He's thinking of leaving the country. He's thinking of giving up art and maybe becoming a writer or something. He's just at his wit's end at this time when he comes to Alaska.
And so he's made a big gamble on Alaska, and he really wants to produce something that's special. How did he pick Fox Island?
Well, you see, Kent liked to travel, what's the word for it, by the seat of his pants. I mean, he didn't really know where he was going. He and his son, his nine-year-old son, well, he was 8 years old at the time, Rockwell Kent III, took a Canadian Pacific train across the country. They landed in Vancouver, then they took a ferry to Victoria and then a ferry to Seattle, and they came up. But in Seattle, he had gotten a letter of introduction from a canning company in Yakutat. He tried to get permission to stay there from them. He'd heard about Yakutat, but they wouldn't give him permission. They didn't want this artist poking around there. But he managed to get a letter of introduction. So his first spot is Yakutat, and he spent some time there. But that's too rough for him. In fact, let me pause here to tell you this, because people might find this interesting. I've started a web page. It's on Facebook. It's called the Rockwell Kent Wilderness Centennial Journal. And what I'm doing is I'm following his movements 100 years from when they happened.
Oh, how neat.
The day that we're talking about this, he's in Yakutat.
Okay.
And so the current entry that I just put on yesterday is going to cover a couple of days and talks about in detail most of the stuff I've gotten from the letters that he's writing to his mistress, Hildegard. About Yakutat. So he stays some time in Yakutat.
So if folks want to find that, they should go to outdoorexplorer.org and find today's show on Rockwell Kent and click on Doug's
right.
a diary. Yeah. That would be yeah. really interesting.
And I'm going to be following him through the winter and revealing a lot of stuff that's in the letters that you're not going to find anywhere.
That's neat. And Doug has shown me some of these original letters of Kent that he's acquired and has the copies of that he brought to the studio. Quite, kind of amazing slice of history. So he's sort of bumming his way up to Alaska. Doesn't know where he's going.
He's in Yakutat, and then Yakutat isn't going to work for him for various reasons. And so he hears about Seldovia. Apparently, I think the canning company in Yakutat had a cannery in Seldovia. So he's going to go to Seldovia. And he takes a steamer, and he lands in Seward. But on the way, he meets a traveler who tells him, why are you going all the way to Yakutat? What you're looking for, you'll find it right here in Seward. And as he enters Resurrection Bay, it must have been a beautiful day, not a rainy day. Mm-hmm. It just inspired him, and he said, wow, this is the place
well, it is I'm incredible.
Going to stay. So he decides
incredible.
To, yeah. He sees the islands.
I would even dare say to the perhaps disagreement of some of my friends in Seldovia that Resurrection Bay is a better spot for a painter because of all the vertical landscape.
He sees the islands, and he was kind of focused on islands. He wanted an island to live on. And he gets to Seward, and he connives an invitation to a berry-picking party out of Kane's Head and then borrows a dory to explore the bay and everything. As he's going into Humpy Cove, he meets this old guy, the old fox farmer on Fox Island, Lars Matt Olson, who's coming out of Humpy Cove. He'd been fishing there. And he tells him what he's looking for, and Olson, just lonely old man, 71 years old, he just takes him in tow and says, you come with me. I'll show you where you want to live.
Hmm.
So that was on, he arrives in Seward on August 24th. 1918.
So the 8-year-old is still trailing along with him this whole time.
The 8-year-old's trailing around with him. And I met the 8-year-old before he died. I interviewed him.
Oh, my gosh.
And since then, he has written a few articles of his memoirs, and I'm using some of those, too, but also some of my interviews with him. So on the 24th, he arrives in Seward. On the 25th, he discovers Fox Island. By the 28th, he settled on Fox Island in August.
And that turned out to be the one place that was best for him to do his work.
That's the one place.
So tell me about, I'm talking with Doug Capra, the author who studied so much about Rockwell Kent on Outdoor Explorer. This 8-year-old son who comes to Alaska and for this super important moment in Alaska's cultural history, and you actually got to meet him. You dropped that little nugget in there. How did that come about? How did you meet Rockwell Kent's son, and how old was he? How long ago was that?
Oh, I met him a few years before he died, so this must have been in maybe 1985 or 1886, I think around there. And what's interesting is, as I mentioned, I was born and raised in Massachusetts, and I worked for newspapers as I was going through college there. And one of the papers I worked for, every day I would drive by his house.
Is that right?
And I didn't, of course, that time I didn't, I didn't know about Rockwell Kent. But anyway, I sat down with him, and actually I revealed to him some things that he didn't know about that had happened in Seward. And he's reading the articles I'd written, and he was going, wow, I didn't know this happened.
Is that right?
And then he gave me his version of it, which was very, very important.
I think that his presence in the story is part of what gives it this dimension and makes it so important to us, because it's not just Rockwell Kent out there being a hermit. He's actually interacting with his son, and his son is there, and that somehow makes it gives it another dimension of interest. What was his time there like with his dad? Was Rockwell Kent a good father? Did he sort of take care of his son properly? And what did the kid learn there?
Oh, well, you know, it's interesting. I know, now Rocky's the son of Rockwell Kent. Rocky's son is Chris Kent, and I know Chris Kent. Chris lived in Homer for a while, and Chris has given me some tremendous insight into his father and his grandfather. But as Chris has told me, that time in Alaska was one of the most important events in his father's life, in little Rocky's life. And you've got to imagine, here you have this active man, this artist who's got, at the time, 4 children, and just intense on his art, and traveling around and moving and very energetic and everything. And he's got to divide his time up between his wife and his children and his art and everything.
And his mistress.
Well, here this little boy, this 8-year-old, turns 9 in October of 1918, has his father all to himself.
Yeah.
You know, so it was a tremendous period of bonding for the two. And if you look at the sketches that he does in the book in Wilderness, you'll see these beautiful sketches of father and son and so forth. So, yes, it was probably one of the most important times in his life.
Wow. So what does Rockwell Kent tell us in his writings and his letters about the inspiration of Fox Island and Resurrection Bay and how it he created this work? Is there sort of an epiphany or something that he has, or is it more just like he's finally found the spot that he needs to be in?
Well, it's a spot. I mean, let me put it this way. Later in life, he would be asked, what's the best place you ever had been to? And he didn't want to say Fox Island, he said, because I don't want to put down all the other places that I've been to. But it's very, very clear when you think about it, when your life is a shambles, everything's falling apart, and you go to a place, a beautiful place like Fox Island, and then your life comes together. Everything happens, everything you've wanted, your goals, you become famous, you can now do what you want to do. So that piece of his life is always associated with Fox Island, that place where it all came together. So it was. In fact, I knew his third wife, Sally, and I remember one time talking to her. I met her when she was in the nursing home, and I asked her, did he ever think about, near the end of his life, Alaska and Fox Island? She said, oh, yes, all the time. In fact, when he died, he was sitting in an armchair. He was signing copies of this edition of the book, the one I wrote the foreword to, that he had published in 1970. It was a special edition. He had the manuscript brought over from the Soviet Union, where he had donated a lot of his art. And he did a whole new edition, putting things into it that weren't in the first original edition. So, yes, Alaska was always a very special place for him.
Yeah. So did he build a shack or something, or did he move into this Fox Farmer's shack? I think if I remember the island correctly, it kind of has two high places, and then there's sort of a low place in between. Am I remembering it right?
Yes, right. Yeah. You've got to imagine Fox Island, the east side of Fox Island is sheer cliffs, okay? And the west side of Fox Island has two coves on it, and the southern cove is Sunny Cove. The northern cove is the cove where Rockwell Kent stayed. And at the time, there was a fox farm and a goat ranch there. And it had been financed by Thomas Hawkins of the Brown and Hawkins General Store in Seward. And he hired and had somewhat of a partnership with Lars Matt Olson. It started about 1915, the fox farm did. And there are several outbuildings here. And there was a shed when Kent visited in August of 1918, a shed that had been built the year before, but over the last winter had been used for goats and other animals. It was just filthy. But when Kent saw it, he had, you know, remember, he'd been trained as an architect. He'd built houses. He was very talented as a carpenter. He looked at that and said, I can turn that into a place where we can spend the winter here.
Huh. And then how long does he stay?
He stayed, let's say he gets out there permanently at the end of August, and he stayed until early in March, and then he stayed a little while in Seward. By the end of March, he's gone.
He missed the good part of the year.
Well, see, that's a whole story, too. And what I'm trying to do is tell the underground story of wilderness. Mm-hmm. You read the book, and it's very focused on the story and the romantic story of wilderness. But underground, he's going through an inner hell because he's trying to get his wife to come up there, and he's trying to get his lover, Hildegard Hirsch, to come up there. He's writing to both of them at the same time. And they know he's writing to both of them. And
he really liked his life complicated, didn't he?
At one point, he wonders, gee, what if they both come? What am I going to do? And then he recalls also that Hildegard Hirsch has a thick German accent. And in my book, I get into this time period. You've got to understand 1918, 1919, 1920. These were very difficult times in American history. The Red Scare, the anti-immigrant movement in the country. I mean, you said the wrong thing, you could end up in jail, taking a position too far to the left. The patriotism was extremely high. This is the period that's happening. So part of what's going on inside, underneath wilderness, is this inner hell that he's going through. His wife is telling him, you know what? I've almost had it here. There are people interested in me, too. That's why he leaves early. He wanted to spend the summer. He wanted to get out into the fjords, do some painting out there. So, but when he gets back, he's in a foul mood. he's not happy, and he's not happy with his wife particularly.
It's not how we think of it happening. Yeah. So in terms of his extreme productivity when he's there, he must have been working very hard producing a lot of paintings. And in wintertime in Resurrection Bay, that's a very tough environment to be in.
Well, you know, let me tell you this. When he was in Yakutat, he considered staying on Knight Island, which is on the east side of Yakutat Bay. And he was going to buy for $20 a dugout canoe.
Wow.
You know, I talk to mariners today and navigators today. They just can't understand what's going on in his mind. So he, in Seward, he buys this small dory, maybe about a 16, 17-foot dory, a broken-down Evinrude engine. Actually, it's a commercial engine that he buys. It weighs over 100 pounds. It doesn't belong on this little dory. And it hangs low on the stern, and it's always breaking down. When it breaks down, it's too heavy. You can't haul it in the boat. So he's got a full boat with all this stuff he's carrying, a 100-pound engine on the end dragging him, and he and little Rocky got a row in the winter.
Wow. Lucky they survived.
Well, I wrote an article called May the Waters of Resurrection Bay Caress Their Bones.
Yeah.
Because in the article I say, by all rights, he should have died out there.
Yeah.
In the wilderness, he writes about that one incident when they're almost killed on their way back from Seward in the winter.
So he must have taken a lot of art supplies, and did he just paint constantly while he was there? I mean, how did he produce so much work?
Well, about the first month, he's fixing the cabin, he's cutting wood, he's got to get a wood supply, and he doesn't really start painting for about a month. To make matters even more difficult, his canvases hadn't arrived. Hmm. So he's painting on plywood, and he's doing a lot of sketches that he'll later sketch. And he's got a camera with him. Hmm. He's one of the artists that use photography. And on the website I'll later post a lot of pictures he took out there of Rocky and the cabin. And I've got pictures I'll post of Olson. We have a lot of photography. One thing is interesting, though. I've never found a photograph of Rockwell Kent in Seward. Hmm. And I find that very strange. But you know how it is. After the book comes out,
that's when you'll find it.
Then the people will say, oh, yeah, I've had this all along. You know?
Yeah. So I'm talking with Doug Capra, author who has done all this work on Rockwell Kent, whose centennial of his visit to Fox Island is coming up. Extremely important Alaska painter and author. When he gets back, obviously he makes this huge impression. That's not easy to do. How did he go from being this low point you're talking about, of all these family problems, financial problems, every other kind of problem, to suddenly becoming the toast of the town?
Well, he goes back to New York, and I mentioned this too. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. While out on Fox Island, someone gives him an idea, and he incorporates himself. This socialist,
he
becomes Rockwell Kent Incorporated, and he designs this beautiful incorporation contract, and he sells shares in himself because he figures, if I don't have to work, I'm so productive, and he was. If you'll just pay me to sit in my studio and work, I can just produce all kinds of stuff, and we can make money. So he buys himself back out in 2 years. But anyway, he comes back to from Alaska in New York, and he has a show in 1919 of just the sketches. And even Little Rocky had some sketches in that show that sold. It was very successful, so successful. And remember, he'd been writing a lot of letters, and he writes these beautifully illustrated letters, beautiful sketches in the letters that were to be circulated among his family and friends. His friends who had read the letters and then look at the pen and inks he did say, you've got to write a book about this. So he goes to Vermont. He buys a farm in Vermont, and he finishes his paintings, and he writes the book. And this is interesting, too. The old fox farmer, Lars Olson, Kent brings him to Vermont.
Oh.
And he's with him in Vermont for a while. That's a whole fascinating story, because they get into an argument. Remember, Kent's in a foul mood in Vermont.
Mm-hmm.
He wants to be back in Alaska. Hmm. He's not happy that he was forced to come back. And even Olson there, he can't really recreate the situation he had on Fox Island. So they get into an argument. Olson takes off to his old stomping grounds before he'd come to Alaska, which was Wyoming and Montana, and he dies there in the winter of 1922. So Kent is in Vermont in 1919, the winter of 1919. In 1920, he has a show of his paintings, and that coincides with the publication of his book Wilderness, and boy, that's it.
It took off.
And that's the beginning of his fame and his ability to earn enough money so he doesn't have to get all these side jobs.
And then he's got another 50 years of his life of being a celebrity. Right. So what was the influence or the importance of this work in terms of Alaska history and in terms of art history and sort of the impact of this work as it went out into the world?
Well, I think the influence, I think, first of all, Douglas Brinkley, who has been writing a series on the history of the conservation movement in the United States, his first book was on Teddy Roosevelt, and then his second book was called The Quiet World, about the conservation movement in Alaska. He contacted me because he wanted to put Rockwell Kent in there, so I sent him some information. And so, I mean, I think finally I was so happy to see that because I think by giving the world these images of what this place looked like, I think eventually that was a little seed that was planted that resulted in Kenai Fjords National Park and the other national parks, the preservation of these places. Other artists, writers were influenced by him. I think of the Fairbanks artist, Claire Fayish. I don't know if you know of her, but Rockwell Kent gave her first show, and they corresponded, and she was influenced by Kent. And Nebraska artist, what's his name, Dale Nichols. And, of course, the well-known Alaska Native artist, George Agapuk. Rockwell Kent found his art in 1935 when he came back and helped promote his art so he could start earning a career. In art. And I mean, I can think of those of you who know a little bit about Alaska history, Barrett Willoughby, one of the early Alaska novelists, I found a letter from her thanking Kent because she had read Wilderness, writes to Kent, and Kent helps her get hooked up with Putnam in New York, who publishes her first book.
And so, she's probably the most popular Alaska writer of all time. People have forgotten all about her,
but
she was a hugely popular writer.
And I just mentioned a few, but I think there are many more people who were influenced by his work, by his book and his paintings.
And I think also, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but there's a whole tradition that follows of writers going to one particular place, appreciating that place over a period of time in the writing, a nature writing book that sort of brings the appreciation of a place over time. I'm thinking of like Henry Beston writing about Cape Cod or even Leopold.
Let me tell you about Henry Beston. When I first read The Outermost House by Henry Beston, I said, you know what? That was written in 1929. I hear echoes of Wilderness in that
exactly.
book. Well, anyway, I finally found through writing to the scholars a letter that Henry Beston writes in 1920. He has seen the Kent paintings in New York in 1920, and he writes this letters to his fiance.
That's a pretty good guess about, on my part,
and
wasn't
you
it?
Read it. he was just so impressed.
Yeah.
So even Henry Beston was influenced by Kent.
And this concept of just go to a place and just take it in and write about that, which has become almost a tradition in American letters in the 20th century.
Well, and not just American letters. When Wilderness came out, some of the critics compared Wilderness to Gauguin's Noah that he wrote about his life in Tahiti. So, you know, there's a whole tradition of that in art.
Fascinating.
Yes.
So what's happening with the centennial? There's it sounds like there's a lot that's getting ready to happen.
Well, let's see. Well, first of all, I want to mention the Facebook page I created. If you go to Facebook and you search for Rockwell Kent Wilderness Centennial Journal, you'll find that. And I started that in late July.
And you mentioned that, and we'll have that linked on Outdoor Explorer, so you can follow it day by day.
Right. And this is kind of a new draft of the book I'm working on.
Oh, neat.
But maybe it'll be a better draft. I don't know. And on the 23rd, I'm going out there with a film crew.
23rd of August.
23rd of August with a film crew that's going to do a 10 or 15 minute YouTube film of Rockwell Kent. Then on the 25th, the Anchorage Museum and Kenai Fjords Tours is sponsoring an evening trip out to Fox Island. I'll do a PowerPoint presentation and depending on the weather, probably lead some people out to where the site of the cabin was. And then in October, the Seward Music and Arts Festival has dedicated that to the art of Rockwell Kent, which if you're interested in Kent's art, you know, they do these stickers and everything. You'll see a lot of Kent images there. And I'll be doing just a short little presentation at the beginning of that. Otherwise, I'm trying to get a symposium going for 2020. 2020 is the 100th anniversary of the publication of Wilderness. Mm-hmm. And the Alaska Historical Society has listed Wilderness as one of the most important, you know, historical books published in Alaska. And I'd like to see a symposium where we can invite a lot of the Kent experts up here, like they did in Newfoundland. They had a symposium. And in Winona, Minnesota, where he was there. Where else? Other places have had these symposiums. Mm-hmm. Vermont had one. There's been some in New York. I think Alaska needs to have a nice symposium, but I'm still hoping that happens.
You've got some time left. I think it's a great topic, and I think that so many people are obviously familiar with the book Wilderness and with his paintings, but it's a good time for people to reconnect with this story, because we're also familiar with Resurrection Bay and the beautiful scenery there, and the connection that that has to the broader world through Rockwell Kent.
Yes, I think so, and I think the period that he lived through was a very difficult time in American history.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it might help people to see that with the times that we're living through today, too. They might see, they might find that interesting.
Yeah, the connection to Wilderness, it can be definitely therapeutic. Great. Well, thank you so much, Doug. This has been fascinating, even more interesting than I expected. Doug Capra is an expert on Rockwell Kent, an author, as he's just described, a lot of different things coming up for the Kent Centennial. Doug is also the author of The Spaces Between, Stories from the Kenai Mountains, the Kenai Fjords, and hundreds of other hundreds of articles. Just really grateful to have you here, Doug. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Please stay with us as Outdoor Explorer continues.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes Store, or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. Our next segment comes from the Trail Tales event put on by Alaska Trails in downtown Anchorage. Our producer, Eric Bork, recorded this story with Dick Griffith, the legendary Alaska tough guy who has inspired generations of adventurers.
So Dick is a little too cantankerous to just tell a story about any of those, so I'm here to put a few of those questions forward. So how does a ranch boy from Colorado learn to paddle a raft?
When you work on a ranch in Wyoming, you do anything to get away from it. That's the way I got away from my ranch.
But when you first went in the water, what happened? You just away from Wyoming?
I built a boat. And my dad helped me. He loaded it up on the car, and he dumped me off in the San Juan River up at San Juan. And I went down the San Juan to Lee's Ferry. I had a wooden boat, and that started it. And I didn't know how to row a boat. I couldn't even row across the lake, but I learned.
And your dad was pretty pleased and proud of you.
Yeah,
and he encouraged it.
He could see I didn't like horses no more. after you get kicked a half a dozen times and, you go through the horse thing, it's hard life.
Yeah. Well, good riddance there. Yeah. Well, other wildlife then, what's the scariest wildlife encounter of your travels?
We might as well get started, I guess. There's been a few. To begin with, I don't know what I'm doing here. I don't even like trails. beaten men follow beaten paths, you know. And Thoreau said that. But to begin with, I ran 17 wilderness races. I completed 17. And I was 54 when I ran the first one. And that was Hope to Homer. And there, some of you people still have a chance out there. You're not quite that old yet. But one of the Hope to Homer races, I took two girls with me. And at first it was Kathy Sarnes and Diane Stonebreaker. And they wanted to be the first two women to do the wilderness race, so I took them along. And my friends accused me of not taking a sleeping bag, and I supposed to slept between two women. It's not true, but it works. But we were in Killy River Canyon, and there was black bears everywhere. There was a cliff on one side of us. 20 feet away, there was a bear trail. Another 20 feet away was the Killy River, which was flooding, and we had to make camp. So we slept on our pack rafts in those days, and I put a tarp up. And I've always been against hanging food up. It just bugs me because the food is very precious on a trip like that. So I put it underneath the boat, and during the night the black bear come up and he was reaching under me to get the food. And I grabbed the bear and I yelled at him, and he took off with my tarp and everything. Yeah, the girls are beginning to wonder about this time, but we made it. And I kept summertime was a big time for me to do this wilderness race. I loved those races because there's no trails. It just go between point A and B, and that was the fun of it. And of course, there are bears, there are brown bears, and there's black bears. You always run into them, but it's no big deal. We never carried a rifle. No one ever carried a rifle or a weapon of any kind. And I was a big-time hunter. In 1980, I hung up my rifle forever. I says, no more killing. And I stuck with that. I waded through black bear, brown bear, polar bears, the whole works. I even had a brown bear. I had a dog, a big dog, that attacked at a brown bear and two cubs. And of course, the brown bear come up the hill at us real fast. My son Barney, he could run faster than I could. And my dog could run faster. So I was back behind, and there was only one thing to do is throw my pack at the bear. And the bear picked up that, it was a Keldy pack frame, aluminum frame. He bit right through it. He was shaking it so hard, and it finally went away. So, you know, you can deal with bears one at a time anyway. But it come, when I started the Northwest Passage, I really started at Nuiqsut, and I skied to Anaktuvuk, down to Bettles, and then I finally went to Allakaket, skied over the Ray Mountains. This is pulling a sled all the time. Skied over the Ray Mountains, and then I went down the Yukon to Koyuk, over to Unalakleet, And a few years later, I decided to ski to Barrow. I can't pronounce the real name now. I haven't learned yet, but you'll have to set Barrow. And that trip took me 63 days, I think. It was 900 miles. And as far as wild animals, bears are nothing compared to fox. There's thousands of fox up there. They pee on your tent, they dig underneath it. They eat the leather straps on your ski poles. And there's one morning I was leaving and I was pulling my sled. I was tied up to my skis and tied up to my sled. And there was a fox, a rabid fox, that ran up and bit me on my leg. And of course, I tried to stab it with my ski poles. And I fell down on the ice. And the fox grabbed me on the glove, tore my glove. And he got me in the shoulder. And I decided that I was rabid. And you know, when you're rabid, you make a lot of stupid mistakes. And I made a bunch of them. I figure I had to get to Kivalina real fast to get this thing checked out. And so there was some smooth ice out there, just fresh ice, new ice, sea ice. So I went out there, and I got about half a mile out, and I fell through the ice. And that's kind of a bad deal because the ice is so soft I had to bust it with my fist until I could get a firm platform to get up on. And I got out of there, and of course it was 10 below. I froze like an icicle right there on the spot. And I got to shore, put up my tent. It was okay. I don't carry spare clothes at all. It's just Salvation Army clothes is all I got. And so I had to crawl my sleeping bag to dry out what clothes I needed to go to the next stage. And I got to Kivalina, and they just laughed at me. Said, the kids get bit all the time. Don't worry about it. They get bit on the way to school. Yeah, so I did. I ignored it. But I got in the Lisburn Hills. That was hard to get across. I crossed one polar bear den with my skis, nothing come out. And a couple hours later, I saw a polar bear. No big, polar bear, it got a bad rap. I don't know what the deal is, but the natives are scared of them. They're very gentle. Believe me, they don't bother you. They're curious. And you can walk through all kinds of them. They'll never bother you as long as they got their fat. It's when they get skinny, they might get a little mean.
Okay.
But I got over and I didn't see any polar bears until I got into Canada, past Kaktovik. And I had one, it was foggy all day. And this polar bear was following me, I think, all day long. And I was out gathering wood up for my wood stove. And this polar bear was in my sled eating my power bars. And you know, wrappers and all. And I hated those power bars. I was so thankful. But I picked up a club and I run this polar bear off. And, you know, no big deal, really. It's just one of those things.
So we have now, for people's takeaways, to have aluminum frame pack and to watch out for the skinny bears. Don't worry about the foxes. Do you have any last words of advice for people today who are looking for the wilderness of that you experienced? What's your last words for those folks?
Stay home. Am I supposed to go on? I have to go to bed at 9 o'clock, so we've got to hurry this up. Okay, well, where was? Oh, it was on polar bears, right?
Yeah. I was
going across, you know, going across. It's 2,500 miles from Barrow to Repulse Bay. That's a long ways to pull a sled. I had a range of 400 miles, which is pretty good. I could go 400 miles with the food I carried in my sled. And there was people that done it with dog teams and snow machines and sailboats, but nobody really ever skied it, and I tried it. And I had to break it up, though. I didn't do it all at once. But I got up, one reason is because I couldn't carry enough butter. You have to eat a lot of butter, and as it was, I lost a half a pound a day. I got so skinny I couldn't keep warm no more. The polar bears weren't even interested in me. Yeah, and I got, I got way over in eastern Canada, and I had a it was early in the morning, the wind was blowing, and there was a polar bear silhouette on my tent. And of course you yell to run it off, and I yelled, and it went away, but I knew I had to get out of the tent. And to get out of the tent, you gotta thaw the zippers with your hands, bare hands, because they're all frozen. And I got out there and I got my sled, and I beat on it with a club, with my ski, come to think of it. And I run this polar bear off, and I didn't think anything about it. And I went back in, and I cooked breakfast on my wood stove. And when I got done, I went back out to load up my sled, and there was the polar bear 50 yards away, laying in the snow, watching me. So I run the bear off again, the same way, and the bear just kind of, he didn't want to leave. He was interested in me, I think. So I went back, I forgot to tell you, but during the night, this polar bear, it ripped my tent. And I didn't even know about it. The wind was blowing through and it had three big rips in it, about this much. And so I went back in and I heated up, I thawed out some fish strips, and I put 10 Advil and 10 Tylenol, and I dropped them in my trail. And this bear followed me for a couple hours and he just kind of disappeared. Yeah? So you really got to think.
That was Dick Griffith speaking of Trail Tales. You can learn more about that event and its sponsor, Alaska Trails, at outdoorexplorer.org. Please stay with us. Small luxury cruises in Southeast Alaska offer guests a chance to explore remote spots in the Tongass National Forest. But there's another kind of tourism happening at the same time, big game hunting. That can be a problem when the two interests overlap. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Elizabeth Jenkins has a story of different groups trying to find a solution.
The Safari Endeavor was designed to give guests the experience of adventure with the comfort of sleeping in high-end sheets. On this ship, you can wake up to locally sourced food and spend the afternoon paddling to a distant cove. Those perks are available to a small passenger list of up to 70 people.
So this is kind of the sun deck.
CEO and owner of UnCruise Adventures, Captain Dan Blanchard, shows me a favorite spot on the boat to take in the scenery or roll out a yoga mat.
So if I were a passenger, is this where I could potentially spot a brown bear from the deck?
It certainly is, and it's something that happens regularly, brown or black bears.
So I could do downward facing dog and then get up and see a bear.
Yeah, do dog. Well, we might call it downward facing bear.
And that's a big part of what Blanchard says UnCruise is all about, being able to view wildlife in this pristine environment.
Most of us that spend time out in Southeast realize that Southeast Alaska is a bastion for wilderness, not just for Alaska, but for our world.
The trips have become so popular, the company has even made a push for an earlier start season. Of course, this safari endeavor is a hunt for the eyes. But last year, on a different UnCruise boat, the hunt became real. As guests peered through binoculars at a bear, they saw a hunter shoot it.
My reaction was, it's bound to happen.
Thor Stacy has been a hunting guide in Alaska for decades. To be clear, it was a local hunter, not a guide, who shot the bear as a boat of surprise tourists watched. Stacy says generally nobody, including hunters, want to see that happen. Still, he thinks as more small cruises expand to the spring and fall, that conflict seems inevitable. That's traditionally the bear hunting season, a time when as many as 20 guides lead clients around the region. He says that's led to frustrations for both small cruises and hunting guides alike. He's heard the complaint.
There's all this country out there. Why can't we just, you know, go where we want in the spring? And we're saying, look, we're already here. We have really important businesses for small communities in Alaskans, and our use has been here since the 1930s.
The Tongass is huge, but small cruises and big game guides can't just go anywhere. They have to obtain special use permits from the U.S. Forest Service. And that becomes a problem when the two ventures overlap. For bear hunters, the scent of an entire boat of people can throw off the animal's behavior. Stacy says hunting guides attracted some of the original adventure tourists to the region. As the small cruise industry expands, he says the game guides are the ones who feel threatened.
In America, the bigger you are, the better things generally work out for you. So when you see a large economic interest like that show up and you're a group of small businesses, the fear of being pushed out or pushed aside is very intense.
Add to that, Stacy says, the misconceptions people have about big game hunting. He stresses this is a regulated industry. He's concerned about the sustainability of the bear population and keeping the Tongass wild just as much as anyone else. So after word got out about the bear shooting by the local hunter, Stacy says it was time for a conversation with the small ships.
We figured if we helped him out, the outcome would likely be much better.
We began to understand about what it means to harvest a bear and how that is controlled.
Dan Blanchard from UnCruise again.
And that, quite frankly, brought more, even though I'm not a bear hunter, it put me at more comfort.
In January, the two groups got together in meetings moderated by the Forest Service to hatch a plan. Hunting guides shared their knowledge and made suggestions on alternative spots for the small cruise ships to explore. There's now a voluntary schedule where the businesses can keep tabs on each other to avoid being at the same place at the same time. Blanchard acknowledges this new agreement so far has been a challenge.
It's not a lot of places, and probably when we go back, we'll need to try to charter some new spots for the small ships next spring.
But Blanchard thinks there's still room for different types of tourism to coexist in the Tongass. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau.
That's all for today's Outdoor Explorer. If you want to learn more about Doug Capra and the Centennial of Rockwell Kent, please check our website at outdoorexplorer.org. You'll find lots of things happening. Also want to thank Dick Griffiths and Alaska Trails and Elizabeth Jenkins from Alaska's Energy Desk. Our producer is Eric Bork. Assistant producer is Hannah Duro. My name is Charles Woolforth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and in your favorite podcast app. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.